Welcome to the BookTree podcast. What should your kids and teens be reading next? To answer that question, we'll be interviewing authors and illustrators, publishers and literacy experts, and other bookish people. We'll also look at current book news and trends and discuss issues around reading and writing. We'll look at the most burning question on all our minds. How do we get kids to read in these screen-obsessed times? Hosted by me, Corinne Rosmarin, journalist and writer. This is a home for all things books, children's and parents' books. After all, children become readers when they see their parents reading too. Come and join us, and let's find out what your kids and you should be reading next.
Welcome to the BookTree podcast.
Hi, today we've got Annalise Clark, an occupational therapist and foundation phase teacher at Bella Vista Share with a master's degree in early childhood intervention. Annalise is going to be talking to us about dyslexia and reading. Her passion lies with inclusion and teaching foundational skills to those with barriers to learning, particularly within the area of literacy. Bella Vista is a small remedial school centrally situated in Johannesburg, Gauteng. She's also the online coordinator and moderator for the award in dyslexia and literacy at Bella Vista Share. I'm not sure, Annalise, what does Share stand for? And welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a privilege. So Bella Vista Share is a section or a part of Bella Vista School that does training for teachers and professionals. And the idea around it is that Bella Vista School is such a niche little school for children with learning difficulties. And the teachers are well-equipped, have so much knowledge, and we feel like it's almost our responsibility to share it, the knowledge and the skills that we have and that we obtain with the rest of the country. So that's why we call it Share. Each part of the word Share stands for something, but it basically all just means that we are willing to share our knowledge and read and delve deeper into what is important for our country to move forward with literacy and numeracy and cognitive skills.
There's absolutely a need for it. And obviously not everyone can afford or is located in a place where they can access a remedial school. I know that from lots of letters that I get sent at the BookTree, people often ask about the link between dyslexia and reading. And there's always this idea that basically if you are dyslexic, because you battle to read the words in the right sequence, that reading is almost impossible. I hesitate with the word impossible, but a lot of parents will say, we're just battling. It's so much hard work. I actually can't get my dyslexic child to read. Do I need to persevere? Is it worth it? First of all, can you just explain for those who are not 100% clear, what does it mean to be dyslexic?
It really is just a different wiring of the brain. Yes, they call it a disability or a disorder. I like to use the word difficulty because it's a different wiring of the brain that just doesn't fit into a system that the majority of people's brains work. So what it really is, if we look at some different definitions, I've just pulled out parts of definitions that are very similar. So there's the International Dyslexia Association, the British Dyslexia Association. There's an Australian one. There's over 40 different definitions for dyslexia. So the main ones we work with is to understand that it's a processing difficulty or a set of processing difficulties, but not every child has all of the different processing difficulties. So usually it involves the phonological component, and that means the sounds that we hear and how we manipulate those sounds to make sense in our brain. The big thing with dyslexia is then that results in a difficulty with learning to read and spell. And often dyslexia is only picked up a little bit later in the grades for teachers that don't know how to do the early identification when the children can't spell.
Right, and they're switching letters around. That's the most typical way that people will characterize dyslexia, right? Is instead of saying a common word like dog, they'll see God, or they will switch two words around. Is that a correct understanding of it, or is that really simplified?
Interesting. It actually isn't a correct understanding of it. That is more a visual processing difficulty.
Wow, okay.
Look, there are visual processing difficulties involved, but that's not the causal factor of dyslexia. So your causal factor is more a combination of things with the majority of the auditory processing. So it's how you hear sounds and how far you can actually determine the uniqueness of a sound. So if I have like car, do I just hear car, or do I hear k, and do I hear the R, or can I only hear car? So there's different levels of understanding as they get older. So the younger kids will, for instance, hear whole words. But as you get older to about 9, you should be able to really swap those individual sounds around, hear those individual sounds, play with them, you know, figure them out at that absolute sound level. And that is where dyslexic children often struggle. So the big thing with children that are dyslexic is that it's very unexpected. It's the kind of child that you would think, but he should really get this. And unfortunately, they get seen as not putting a lot of effort into their work, but they actually work so hard. And maybe later when we talk about the reading brain, it will make a little bit more sense. But it's the child where you think, no, they should really be able to do this because look how good their maths are. Look how well they speak. Look how good they are at sports or whatever it is, what other skills they've acquired, all their other skills so well. And then they struggle with this one thing that we would expect them to do well in.
If a child is presenting with a difficulty in reading, people will often be quick to label it and say, well, it must be dyslexia or it's a offshoot of ADHD. How do you differentiate between those?
That's quite difficult. Something that is very important is regardless of whether they are dyslexic or just struggle with reading because they weren't exposed enough when they were younger or they had poor instruction at a grade R or grade 1 level, we don't really always know those things. But regardless of whether it is poor instruction or whether it is dyslexia, the intervention principles remain the same. We can easily get fixated on a diagnosis, but the intervention principles that we use to help children read will be very much the same. And then when you start that, those children that still struggle despite really good intervention, those are the ones that usually are truly dyslexic.
Can you tell me, how does the literacy journey look for a child with dyslexia? So, for example, do they still go through the process of learning their phonological skills, you know, the rote learning of the alphabet from that foundation phase? Or do you think it is important for a dyslexic child to either go to a remedial school or undergo a different method of teaching them how to read?
It all depends on the severity of the dyslexia as well. So dyslexia exists on a continuum. You can be mildly dyslexic or severely dyslexic. As I said, in the definition of dyslexia, they talk about the different processes that are deficient or that are affected. And it depends how many of those processes. So if you have a phonological processing difficulty, that's one thing. If you have a phonological processing difficulty and a working memory and a rapid naming, then you have severe dyslexia because there's so much else that's intertwined into it.
What is a rapid naming? That sounds interesting.
So rapid naming is, it's a retrieval of words that come to mind. So if I've learned the sounds, for instance, and I've got a good idea of the alphabet sounds and the alphabet letters, and I have an understanding that putting these sounds together make a word. But when my brain sees the sound k and the sound an and the sound t, it takes a long time to make the connections. And so reading becomes really slow. They'll be able to decode it and they'll be able to read it, but everything is really slow. So rapid naming, it often happens even when they speak. They don't always get the words that they want to say. It is there, they know the word, but it just doesn't come out of the brain as fast as what it would for other people.
Right, okay.
There's some researchers that call difficulty with phonological processing and rapid naming a double deficit. And those are your severe dyslexics.
Obviously, we know that a lot of dyslexic people are not geniuses necessarily, but super intelligent. And some of them may be geniuses as well. How do you think a parent who's been told that their child is dyslexic, you know, you can feel overwhelmed and think, well, this is going to be the end of their educational journey. How am I going to handle this? What does the prognosis look like? And obviously, I know there's, according to the continuum, it could be worse for some and, you know, easier for others. What do you advise a parent who's been told that their child is dyslexic?
It really isn't the end of the world. And they really can complete many school levels and degrees and doctorates. And very interestingly, there's so many dyslexic people that have gone to major in English, for instance, at university, just because they almost want to prove to the world that they are able to. The thing is, if they get good instruction and good intervention, they really are able to do anything that everyone else is doing just at a slower pace. I want to go back a little bit just when you were saying that often the children or people with dyslexia has got some other really good cognitive skills. When we look at the brain, the reading brain for the average person, you know, we were never born to read. So our brain has to create its own circuit when we start reading. And it starts at the back of the brain where you can see the visual part on the paper, like your letters, and then it moves to the sides of your brain and the middle of your brain. And that's where the sound symbol correlations are made and where the language processing happens. And then it moves to the front part of the brain where your articulation takes place. And obviously all of that happens in a really, really quick progression and interaction. And it's like all in milliseconds. But what happens with a dyslexic learner is that their brains focus a lot on the frontal part of the brain, their reading, because the front part of the brain is that area where you do a lot of planning, a lot of problem solving. It's the deeper, slower things that we work with. And now, because they can't get the other parts activated the way that other people can, they use their frontal cortex a lot, meaning that they are actually exercising that planning and problem solving parts, which then for other skills, you know, it's easier for them to solve a problem or to plan ahead or to use that executive functioning. They're practicing that part. Where for kids where reading is automatic because their circuitry works quickly and really well, they don't have to use their frontal cortex a lot unless they get to maths where they have to learn problem solving or where they have to make a plan somewhere. But because the dyslexic children are always using that, and obviously it's very tiring and very slow, they're growing skills that other kids don't get.
I really love that explanation because it does make you realize if you have a child who's dyslexic, is just to understand that their strength will lie in different areas and that they can still get to the same endpoint. It's just that their journey to get there will look different. It struck me when you said we weren't born to read. It's such a simple statement, and it makes such a lot of sense if you think about it. So we have to create this whole new circuit. And I'm just wondering, what do you think we can do for young children when we're starting out to encourage this journey? There are some schools of thought that believe that we don't start the reading journey until they are much older. In the UK, for example, they start when the children are around 4. Do you think that there is a middle line? How should we be introducing the learning or the reading skills to our children?
I think the important part is from when they are babies, they need to be read to. So obviously we're not going to make them read when they're very little, like in 2-year-olds, but being read to and holding a book and cuddling together and having that relationship of I'm reading a beautiful story to you and the world of another story is opening up other than the world that you know at home, that already creates a huge pathway for them to develop their own reading. And reading to them develops their vocabulary. So they learn new words, they learn new contexts. Because learning to read requires what we call the language comprehension as well as word recognition. So at school, they learn word recognition. They learn how to sound out words and make a word. And obviously, you continue your language comprehension. But as a young baby or a young child, you learn your language comprehension. You learn what words mean. You learn the context of words, you get some semantics, you know, how things are said, the grammatical way of how things are said. That all happens through reading. The more a parent can read to a child, the better. And then there's been a huge amount of research around when a child should learn to read themselves. And interestingly, whether they start when they are 7 or whether they start when they are 4, by the time they get to grade 3, they're at the same level. It really depends on, I guess, the country that you're in. But I don't think we should push our children to learn to read text if they're not ready. But what we should be doing is doing lots of rhyming, lots of sing-song, lots of reading to them. I mean, I'm that mom where in my house when my kids were little, I would only have books that rhyme. Because rhyming helps to develop that sense of some patterns in words are the same. It sort of creates a bit of a foundation of how language is built. And obviously, this is only in English because not all languages have good rhyming. So a lot of our native languages don't actually have rhyming in it.
Part of this journey is the ability to comprehend what they are actually reading. And there's a term called metacognition, basically the ability to think about how you are thinking. And it's something that happens quite smoothly and naturally when you read a lot and you just start to get into the habit of, as you're reading something, you're able to start thinking about it and almost making those connections in your brain without having to stop and think about the connections you're making. How difficult is it for a child with dyslexia to do this?
It actually is the only way for a child with dyslexia to start reading or to learn how to read, because they are, again, like I said earlier with the reading brain, they are using their frontal lobe a lot more, and they need that executive functioning to learn to read. So when we look at the principles of learning to read for children who struggle, which, by the way, is very effective for all instruction, not just for those who struggle, the instruction has to be structured. So it has to follow almost the same sequence every time so that they're not surprised by strange elements coming into the lesson. So they almost know what to expect, mm-hmm. because children with dyslexia also, and ADHD and most of our neurodevelopmental difficulties, struggle with organization. So if we can structure each session almost the same, so you start, say, with alphabet work, and then you move to sound play, and then you move to your new sound for the week or whatever it is, so you have a proper structure. That's one of the principles. And the other one is that it is cumulative. We often talk about synthetic phonics, where we don't teach the sounds, for instance, in alphabetical order, because it doesn't help them. We would rather teach maybe first the I or the E sound and then the T, which is the T sound, so that immediately after two sessions, they can make it. So there's a meaning and comprehension already in your first two sounds that you've worked with. Then multisensory is another principle. So there you look at always using auditory and visual and kinesthetic together. So let them, you know, make the letters big with their arm movements, jump it, rub it in sand, whatever they can do that's physical as well. Because some children learn very well auditory and others learn very well visually and others learn very well kinesthetically. And we don't know who's learning which way. So bringing in all the senses at the same time almost strengthens the pathways.
Do you think that your average teacher is able to do this kind of instruction? You're talking about these three different approaches to learning sounds, you know, the words, the feel of the words. And I'm just wondering, it would make me worry that perhaps my child would fall through the cracks in that class if they didn't learn in a certain way.
This is the researched way, and it is really not difficult to implement. I mean, of course, we all need training on it, and that's what we do at SHARE. But this is almost a universal principles. You can use your phonics program that you are given, and you can use programs that you are given in your classroom. But I have a really wonderful saying that I always use is, programs don't teach, teachers teach. Mm. And a good teacher can take any program and make it work according to those principles.
And so does SHARE actually publish different programs that anyone can use? Can a parent go onto your website and access programs?
So what we're very firm about is that a teacher needs to be able to know what they're doing. So we have got some long courses for teachers, which is our award in literacy and dyslexia, where we teach these principles and we teach the whole background of dyslexia, for instance, and all the ways to implement it. And then after that training, they can really use any program. So we don't have specific programs that we sell or anything, because we don't want teachers to feel like there's one more thing they have to do. It really is just to gain the skills and the insight and using the right evidence-based and research-based principles and implementing that into the system they already are in.
Okay. I do know that Bellavista uses technology in tackling dyslexia and learning. Can you give us an example of how you do this?
We do use technology, not a huge amount. It depends also on the ages of the learners and each individual child's need. And again, I think that's where the whole thing comes in from programs, because every child that has a learning difficulty presents completely differently. So we can't just put them through the same thing. And each child obviously needs a different approach. And so for our technology, it all depends on the child. But we do use a lot of speech to text and text to speech for the older learners that really struggle or that just fall behind. And we still feel it's necessary to use pencil and paper for that formation of the letters, so they have that multisensory approach. And then as they get older, text-to-speech, speech-to-text. The other thing that really helps the dyslexic learners, they get very overwhelmed. And again, I spoke about organizational skills, where we can make text bigger or smaller or eliminate parts of text as they need them, sort of give it to them in chunks so that it's not all, you know, a whole page full of stuff, because then they get quite overwhelmed. So that is where technology really helps. And then we do use some apps. Instead of, say, spelling homework, we would give them something like Reading X to do, which is also a synthetic phonics program. And obviously, we're not affiliated with them at all, but it's a really lovely program to use, where the child will then go through some of the sounds, learn how to blend them, how to make words, and almost reinforce what's being done in the school.
So is Reading Eggs available for all ages? And it's an online program?
It's an online program. It's a paid-for program. Actually, many of our schools use it. I've seen some of the schools that use it. And it basically is just your sounds, putting the sounds together. It makes a huge difference in doing something like that at home for homework, instead of where I'm already struggling to write and spell, to sit after a full day of school where I've used my brain a lot harder than the other kids to now go and do that. So it's much easier for them to then be on a tablet.
And if you can recommend the types of books that parents should look for, you've mentioned obviously that it can be overwhelming when there's a lot of text and a lot of pictures. And I know that there are actually some books now that are being created, particularly for children with dyslexia, where they will think about the font, they will think about how many words are on a page. But what kind of books do you think parents should look for?
Even within the foundation phase, it depends on the age and whether or not the book is being read to the child or if the child is reading the book. So when the child is reading the book, there's so much research now going into decodable reading, to not give them books where they have to read the word dinosaur because there's a picture of the dinosaur on the page. You know, because when they get to dinosaur, when there's no picture, there's no way they're going to be able to sound that word out. There is no research that shows that pictures help us learn to read. So if they are grade 1, 2, and maybe first bits of grade 3, they really need those decodable books where every sound that they have learned is in that book and not sounds that they haven't learned. So things like thought and bought, I mean, those are very difficult spelling patterns. They wouldn't have learned those yet. So let's not put them in those books. But short sentences for the grade ones, literally 3 or 4 words in a sentence of sounds that they have learned. When it comes to reading to the child, I would again recommend rhyming books. And if they really are keen, because you know that you also don't want to hold a child back. If they are very keen to read books that are not decodable, then we can read with them in a way called paired reading. You read together, word for word, and like a choir would sing together. And it helps them with that automaticity, and the words that they then don't know, you've read it with them. So you're not getting them to try sound it out because you know they're not going to be able to. So it's then a story that flows, and they just, the words that they can read with you, they will, and those that they can't, they don't.
I've actually written a piece about paired reading on my website that just explains that it can be used for any child who's battling or just learning how to read. It's a lovely way of sharing that journey, I think.
As they get older, the audiobooks are also brilliant because then they can read along in their book and listen to the audiobook at the same time. And so they are exposed to what it should sound like, what the pace should be, and then what it looks like in front of me. So that's really helpful too. And you do get some audiobooks for younger kids too, which is lovely.
I was actually going to ask you about the audiobooks because I do have a friend whose child is dyslexic. And one of the ways they found around it is just to play a lot of audiobooks. Also just when they drive in the car all the time, just to have these words being heard constantly.
That's very important because I spoke earlier about the language comprehension side of learning to read. And we don't want them to miss out on that because children that are avid readers read a lot, so they learn a lot more and they learn so many more words. And then children that struggle to read, read less and read slower, so their word intake is much slower and their vocabulary bank is much smaller. So if they can have audiobooks, that at least grows their vocabulary and they can, on an auditory level and on a verbal level, be much stronger. So definitely always audiobooks.
Is there anything else you'd like to share for parents out there who are listening to this and maybe are kind of worried about how to guide their children?
I think not to get despondent is the biggest thing. They will learn, but to be able to try identify it as soon as you can is very important, because our brains are so much more plastic when they're younger, meaning that the pathways with good intervention can get laid out much easier. Whereas if you're older, or you're an adult, or you're a teenager, and even like from age nine and up, your pathways are much harder to create, and it takes a lot more overlearning and repetition. It is very difficult for the older learners to want to work with sounds. It's one of the only ways we can do it, because they need to learn how to decode. But if we can tackle this when they're much younger, then there's not that emotional component involved as well. And then when they are a bit older, and if you have a diagnosis, that's great. If you don't, and they would need concessions, go for those concession assessments with an educational psychologist to give them that reading or scribe concession or the extra time that they need, because there's so much in their brains that they are able to share, and they're just not going to put it out on paper because it's just too effortful. So get those concessions done for high school as well.
Absolutely. I think just along with the whole idea of not getting despondent, I had dinner last week with a woman who really has, I think, reached the top of her field. And she told me over dinner that she's actually dyslexic. And she said that it really shaped who she is, obviously. And it made her work harder, as you say. And I think that also what's happening now is because we're becoming so much more aware of the whole focus on neurodivergency and how people process information differently. She was telling me that they are even looking at the interview process when they're looking at a person. Some people present really, really well. Verbally, they can seem like they can do the job amazingly well. And you'll have somebody else who comes in and they're perhaps shyer or more introverted, or they just don't communicate their thoughts very well. And the studies have shown that often those people are the ones who end up doing the job better. So now they're even looking at the interview process and trying to understand how can you make sure that the person you're hiring is presenting in the best of their abilities and you don't lose out on those people. So there's so much hope, and I think the world is changing. It's a different place from how it was even, 20 years ago.
Yes, it absolutely is. I think I've actually got quite a few friends that are dyslexic. They are all business owners. I've got friends that are dyscalculic, which is more on the math side. And I think something to remember is all these neurodevelopmental difficulties are intertwined. So it's very seldom that you only have one thing. So you're only dyslexic. So most often you are dyslexic and have ADHD. And what happens is if you have ADHD, yes, school is hard because you're struggling to concentrate and to keep your focus. But wow, what amazing ideas you can generate in such quick time when you are an adult and running a business. Yeah, all these intertwining neurodevelopmental things that are difficulties as children, hopefully with good support and good parental guidance and motivation, will keep them strong for when they're older.
Annelise Clark, thank you so, so much for talking to us today. It's been so interesting. And I think that for all those parents who have been worrying about their children or just want a way forward, you've given us so many options and ideas to work from. And it was wonderful to have you today.
It's time to dive into the pages of the book review.
I was sent a copy of a book called Pinch Perkins and the Midsummer Curse from Jonathan Ball Publishers. And I'm going to review it because it was such a well-written book and it was completely captivating. But most importantly, it's aimed at a very important group of readers that I'm always looking for good books for. And those are the aged 8 to 12-year-olds who love the Harry Potter series and the Percy Jackson series, and they're always looking for a new series to get hooked into. And I think I might have found a great new series for them. The author, Kathy Fitzgerald, is an exciting new voice in the very busy field of children's fantasy. She manages to stand out because of her great characterization and her world building. I also think she's very good at structuring her story, and she's cleverly woven in fairy tales and legends into the story, from King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table, including Sir Lancelot, who now owns a burger joint, to the Sleeping Beauty curse, which her mum has fallen under. But let me not get ahead of myself. Let me get to the plot of the story. Pinch is a young 12-year-old girl who lives on Tricky Dragon Lane, deep within London's magical quarter. When her mother falls victim to a dark sleeping curse, Pinch feels she can't leave it up to the adults to find a cure. And racing against the clock on Midsummer's Eve, one of the most magical nights of the year, Pinch sets off on a quest that plunges her into a fantastical world of legendary heroes, terrifying fairies, and strange creatures, not to mention weird ghost-like characters that can fly in and out of mirrors. Helping her every step of the way is her nemesis, Henry de Salot, her always organized and somewhat patronizing young neighbor, who knows just how to get out of the magical quarter and into the humdrum human world. I find Pinch Perkins a really lovable protagonist. She's messy, she's determined, she's quick-witted, and she's full of heart. And really, she's motivated by the love of her mom and trying to find out what or who has put her under the spell. Her nemesis, Henry de Salot, is also her neighbor, and he is described as having a long white face with a sharp chin, straight black hair cut around his ears, and the kind of smarmy smile naive parents fell for every time. The funny thing is that as the story goes on, Pinch starts to learn more about his character and who he is. And I won't give it away, but there's a lot more to him than meets the eye. The other characters also all hold some surprises. The fact that the fairy queen and the king are rather awful people is a lovely twist. You know, you're used to fairies being sweet and kind and flying through the air and dispelling glitter, but these two are quite awful. Then there's the henchmen, Harem and Scarum, and they are particularly memorable. They love to squeeze people to death, but nothing too bad happens in the story, so don't worry if you are worried about it being too violent for your middle grade readers. Although I do think that children these days can actually handle a lot more than we give them credit for. I haven't even touched on all the other memorable characters because there really are so many. But I have to mention the world building, which is really special in this book. And it's something that I think that the author, Kathy Fitzgerald, is particularly talented at. You know, it's the kind of thing that distinguishes a good book from a superb book. How believable and complete is the world that the author creates for you? Writing fantasy is not just about writing a story filled with fantastical creatures and beings living in a candy land or a place where you can have magical machines and animals. It's really about creating a world that feels believable. If you think about the world of Harry Potter, you can imagine everything in that story has become part of our culture. We think of Quidditch, for example, the game that they play, as a proper game. You know, Rowling created rules and equipment. Fitzgerald does something quite similar with the aspects of the book. For example, she's created a underground magical transportation system. It's similar to your subway system in England. And this is called the Hare Underground Rapid Transit Labyrinth, HURTL for short. In this system, giant rabbits or hares pull open-top sleighs through the city. Little aspects like this and others, like you can buy your spells from a shop called Spellmart, they all add up to create a world that feels quite believable. Interestingly enough, there are some parallels between the Harry Potter world and Pinch Perkins' world. And I think it's hard to avoid, but for example, the whole section of Tricky Dragon Lane often made me think about the Diagon Alley in Harry Potter, because it had a similar feeling of a cobblestoned wizarding alley with unusual shops. For example, in the Pinch Perkins book, there's a shop called Marvelous Magic Mirrors, and it has all these amazing mirrors that can almost come to life. You can see different things when you look inside them. But I think it's hard to stay away from, you know, creating a magical world, especially since it's set in London, that is not going to be a little bit like Harry Potter. All in all, I think that Pinch Perkins and the Midsummer Curse is perfect for children who love fantasy, adventure, they love a strong heroine together with memorable cast of characters. And I really believe that this is going to be a very exciting debut for the author. And also, I'm looking forward to the sequel, which is coming out next year already. So that's also another great thing for your young readers. They don't have to wait too long to get the next book. I want to talk a little bit about the celebrity author trend. I'm talking about the trend for celebrities to write children's books. This is basically based on the idea that celebrities are building a brand and writing a children's book is an extension of that brand. And sometimes it's because celebrities have their own children and they may think that writing a children's book is either easy or it's just been a passion. They've always wanted to write a book and now they've got their own children and that's what they start to do. But interestingly, Keira Knightley is the latest celebrity to announce that she's penning a children's book. And the backlash has been huge.
full-time authors are very frustrated by this trend because they say that it makes it seem like being a writer is a side hustle. It's not a full-time job. When Keira Knightley made her announcement, author Charlotte Levine actually joked in a now viral tweet that she's decided to become a film star on the side. What many writers are upset about is the one-way ticket that celebrities have to publishing. Whereas for most, the normal path is really hard. It's a very tough query procedure they go through, and they can send out query letters to up to 100 publishers, hoping that somebody will read their story and love it. So famous people will benefit from a built-in audience. They'll have media coverage already to promote their book, which makes it really clear why publishing houses love them. And then there's a high number of children's books written by celebrities that are actually written by ghostwriters. So the celebrities put their name on the cover, but actually it's been written by somebody else. And author Catherine Rundell recently penned a piece just complaining about the number of ghostwritten books. The reason why these authors are complaining is because it does take away from the number of books that can be published by authors. And again, it does make it seem like writing a children's book is quite easy. But research has shown that parents often don't really mind if the book is well written or badly written. If it has a celebrity's name on it, they're going to buy it. I remember receiving Madonna's book back in 2003. It was called The English Roses, and my daughter absolutely loved it. I don't think she paid any attention to how it was written. I remember reading the story to her, and she loved the friendships and the life of these girls all living in London. So there it does go to say that if a book is entertaining, it has a certain value. But all of this is to say that if I recommend a book and it's a celebrity book, I won't do so unless I feel that it ticks more than just being written by a celebrity author. It has to be entertaining, well-written, and well-plotted, well-thought-out. One such book is Cook Off at Gogo's Spaza, written by our very own Salamina Mosese, actress, MC, TV host, and film producer. You may know her from being a presenter on Top Billing and for her role in series like Seven de Laan, Soul City, and Earth Saunders. I'm reviewing her book because I really do feel like it is well written and entertaining, and I love the storyline. It's the second book in the Gogo's Spaza series. The first one was called Disaster at Gogo's Spaza, and they are published by Human and Rousseau. They're recommended for ages 6 to 9. The storyline follows Tumi and her twin cousins, Mpo and Lefa, and they spend their holidays at their Gogo's house in Soweto. In Cook Off at Gogo's Spaza, Tumi and her cousins have decided to help their Gogo win a cooking competition because Gogo has a amazing, very popular spaza shop called Gogo's Goodies Spaza in the heart of Soweto. When they find out that there's a cooking competition, they think that Gogo should enter, of course, because they love her food. And at first, Gogo doesn't want to enter. She thinks that this is not really for her, and I think she's a little bit nervous about it. But eventually, everyone gets in on the job, and they all say to her she has to enter because her food is so delicious. So from here, we see the well-meaning twins and Tumi trying to influence Gogo's selection of recipes and what she's going to make, because they think that she should make something a little bit more exotic. Tumi is convinced she should try and add a bit of French flair, while Mpo, all her ideas are around the presentation because she loves fashion. And Lefa wants to spice everything up and add sweets and exotic ingredients. What happens from there is pure chaos. Basically, Gogo has her own way of doing things. The twins and Tumi, without giving too much away, decide to add a few very exotic ingredients, and I will just say that snails are part of them, and their meddling becomes a recipe for disaster. Vian Olufson's illustrations bring the text alive. The expressions in the children's faces, from earnest and excited to scared and then relieved, make us connect with them. The characterization of Gogotina is spot on. She's the perfect grandmother, strict but kind, loving, and understanding. With grandmothers playing such a central role in so many children's lives, it's powerful to have her as a role model. You know, a successful businesswoman, and she shows the children the benefit of hard work. And even when the grandchildren drive her mad, she's still good-natured and kind. I think it's every child's dream to have their own little business. So Tumi's excitement at being involved in her grandmother's spaza shop is really palpable and understandable. I actually can see her running her own spaza one day. The children learn to accept responsibility for their actions and to understand that they don't always know what is best. And sometimes, unrequested meddling is more of a hindrance than a help. I love the South African setting of Soweto and the cast of characters who make up their typical life in the neighbourhood. Cook Off at Gogo's Spaza
published by Human and Rousseau and written by Salamina Mosese, is perfect for ages 6 to 9. Buy it. Your children will love the story. Thank you for joining us at the Book Tree Podcast. I really enjoyed talking to Annelise Clark, and it's so reassuring to see how the world is finally beginning to understand that dyslexia and other neurodivergent conditions are simply different ways of seeing and processing the world. Please sign up and follow us, and let us know what you'd like to hear about next. Until then, happy reading!